Disc 9.
Chapter 96. Susan was wet and shivering, huddled on the Node 3 couch. Strathmore draped his suit coat over her shoulders. Hale's body lay a few yards away. The sirens blared. Like ice thawing on a frozen pond, Translator's hull let out a sharp crack. "I'm going down to kill power," Strathmore said, laying a reassuring hand on her shoulder. "I'll be right back." Susan stared absently after the commander as he dashed across the crypto floor. He was no longer the catatonic man she'd seen 10 minutes before. Commander Trevor Strathmore was back, logical, controlled, doing whatever was necessary to get the job done. The final words of Hale's suicide note ran through her mind like a train out of control. "Above all, I'm truly sorry about David Becker. Forgive me, I was blinded by ambition." Susan Fletcher's nightmare had just been confirmed. David was in danger, or worse. Maybe it was already too late. "I'm truly sorry about David Becker." She stared at the note. Hale hadn't even signed it. He'd just typed his name at the bottom. Greg Hale. He'd poured out his guts, pressed print, and then shot himself. Just like that. Hale had sworn he'd never go back to prison. He'd kept his vow. He'd chosen death instead.
"David,"
she sobbed.
"David."
At that moment, 10 feet below the crypto floor, Commander Strathmore stepped off the ladder onto the first landing. It had been a day of fiascos. What had started out as a patriotic mission had swerved wildly out of control. The commander had been forced to make impossible decisions, commit horrific acts, acts he'd never imagined himself capable of. It was a solution. It was the only damn solution. There was duty to think of, country and honor. Strathmore knew there was still time. He could shut down Translator. He could use the ring to save the country's most valuable data bank. Yes, he thought. There was still time. Strathmore looked out over the disaster around him. The overhead sprinklers were on. Translator was groaning. The sirens blared. The spinning lights looked like helicopters closing in through dense fog. With every step, all he could see was Greg Hale, the young cryptographer gazing up, his eyes pleading, and then the shot. Hale's death was for country, for honor. The NSA could not afford another scandal. Strathmore needed a scapegoat. Besides, Greg Hale was a disaster waiting to happen. Strathmore's thoughts were jarred free by the sound of his cellular. It was barely audible over the sirens and hissing fumes. He snatched it off his belt without breaking stride.
"Speak!
Where's my passkey?" a familiar voice demanded.
"Who is this?"
Strathmore yelled over the din.
"It's Numataka," the angry voice bellowed back. "You promised me a passkey."
Strathmore kept moving.
"I want Digital Fortress,"
Numataka hissed.
"There is no Digital Fortress," Strathmore shot back.
"What?"
"There is no unbreakable algorithm."
"Of course there is. I've seen it on the internet. My people have been trying to unlock it for days."
"It's an encrypted virus, you fool, and you're damn lucky you can't open it."
"But
the deal is off," Strathmore yelled. "I'm not North Dakota. There is no North Dakota. Forget I ever mentioned it."
He clamped the cellular shut, turned off the ringer, and rammed it back on his belt. There would be no more interruptions. 12,000 miles away, Tokugen Numataka stood stunned at his plate glass window. His umami cigar hung limply in his mouth. The deal of his lifetime had just disintegrated before his eyes. Strathmore kept descending. "The deal is off. Numatech Corp would never get the unbreakable algorithm, and the NSA would never get its back door." Strathmore's dream had been a long time in the planning. He'd chosen Numatech carefully. Numatech was wealthy, a likely winner of the passkey auction. No one would think twice if it ended up with the key. Conveniently, there was no company less likely to be suspected of consorting with the U.S. government. Tokugen Numataka was old world Japan. Death before dishonor. He hated Americans. He hated their food, he hated their customs, and most of all, he hated their grip on the world's software market. Strathmore's vision had been bold. A world encryption standard with a back door for the NSA. He'd longed to share his dream with Susan, to carry it out with her by his side. But he knew he could not. Even though Ensai Tankado's death would save thousands of lives in the future, Susan would never have agreed. She was a pacifist. I'm a pacifist too, thought Strathmore. I just don't have the luxury of acting like one. There had never been any doubt in the commander's mind who would kill Tankado. Tankado was in Spain, and Spain meant Hulahot. The 42-year-old Portuguese mercenary was one of the commander's favorite pros. He'd been working for the NSA for years. Born and raised in Lisbon, Hulahot had done work for the NSA all over Europe. Never once had his kills been traced back to Fort Meade. The only catch was that Hulahot was deaf. Telephone communication was impossible. Recently, Strathmore had arranged for Hulahot to receive the NSA's newest toy, the Monocle computer. Strathmore bought himself a sky pager and programmed it to the same frequency. From that moment on, his communication with Hulahot was not only instantaneous, but also entirely untraceable. The first message Strathmore had sent Hulahot left little room for misunderstanding. They had already discussed it. Kill Ensai Tankado. Obtain passkey. Strathmore never asked how Hulahot worked his magic, but somehow he had done it again. Ensai Tankado was dead, and the authorities were convinced it was a heart attack. A textbook kill. Except for one thing. Hulahot had misjudged the location. Apparently, Tankado dying in a public place was a necessary part of the illusion. But unexpectedly, the public had appeared too soon. Hulahot was forced into hiding before he could search the body for the passkey. When the dust settled, Tankado's body was in the hands of Seville's coroner. Strathmore was furious. Hulahot had blown a mission for the first time ever, and he'd picked an inauspicious time to do it. Getting Tankado's passkey was critical, but Strathmore knew that sending a deaf assassin into the Seville morgue was a suicide mission. He had pondered his other options. A second scheme began to materialize. Strathmore suddenly saw a chance to win on two fronts. A chance to realize two dreams instead of just one. At 6:30 that morning, he had called David Becker. Chapter 97. Fontaine burst into the conference room at a full sprint. Brinkerhoff and Midge were close at his heels.
Look!
Midge choked, motioning frantically to the window. Fontaine looked out the window at the strobes in the cryptodome. His eyes went wide. This was definitely not part of the plan. Brinkerhoff sputtered,
"It's a goddamn disco down there!"
Fontaine stared out, trying to make sense of it. In the few years Translator had been operational, it had never done this.
It's overheating, he thought.
He wondered why the hell Strathmore hadn't shut it down. It took Fontaine only an instant to make up his mind. He snatched an interoffice phone off the conference table and punched the extension for crypto. The receiver began beeping as if the extension were out of order. Fontaine slammed down the receiver.
Damn it!
He immediately picked up again and dialed Strathmore's private cellular line. This time, the line began to ring. Six rings went by. Brinkerhoff and Midge watched as Fontaine paced the length of his phone cable like a tiger on a chain. After a full minute, Fontaine was crimson with rage. He slammed down the receiver again.
Unbelievable! He bellowed. Crypto's about to blow and Strathmore won't answer his goddamn phone.
Chapter 98. Hulahot burst out of Cardinal Guerra's chambers into the blinding morning sun. He shielded his eyes and cursed. He was standing outside the cathedral in a small patio, bordered by a high stone wall, the west face of the Giralda Tower, and two wrought iron fences. The gate was open. Outside the gate was the square. It was empty. The walls of Santa Cruz were in the distance. There was no way Becca could have made it so far, so quickly. Hulahot turned and scanned the patio.
He's in here. He must be.
The patio, Jardín de los Naranjos, was famous in Seville for its 20 blossoming orange trees. The trees were renowned in Seville as the birthplace of English marmalade. An 18th century English trader had purchased 3 dozen bushels of oranges from the Seville church and taken them back to London, only to find the fruit inedibly bitter. He tried to make jam from the rinds and ended up having to add pounds of sugar just to make it palatable. Orange marmalade had been born. Hulahot moved forward through the grove, gun leveled. The trees were old, and the foliage had moved high on their trunks. Their lowest branches were unreachable, and the thin bases provided no cover. Hulahot quickly saw the patio was empty. He looked straight up. The Giralda. The entrance to the Giralda's spiral staircase was cordoned off by a rope and a small wooden sign. The rope hung motionless. Hulahot's eyes climbed the 419-foot tower and immediately knew it was a ridiculous thought. There was no way Becker would have been that stupid. A single staircase wound straight up to a square stone cubicle. There were narrow slits in the wall for viewing, but there was no way out. David Becker climbed the last of the steep stairs and staggered, breathless, into a tiny stone cubicle. There were high walls all around him and narrow slits in the perimeter. No exit. Fate had done Becker no favors this morning. As he dashed from the cathedral into the open courtyard, his jacket had caught on the door. The fabric had stopped him mid-stride and swung him hard left before tearing. Becker was suddenly stumbling off balance into the blinding sun. When he'd looked up, he was heading straight for a staircase. He'd jumped over the rope and dashed up. By the time he realized where it led, it was too late. Now he stood in the confined cell and caught his breath. His side burned. Narrow slats of morning sun streamed through the openings in the wall. He looked out. The man in the wire-rimmed glasses was far below, his back to Becker, staring out at the plaza. Becker shifted his body in front of the crack for a better view.
"Cross the plaza," he willed him.
The shadow of the Giralda lay across the square like a giant felled sequoia. Hulahot stared the length of it. At the far end, 3 slits of light cut through the tower's viewing apertures and fell in crisp rectangles on the cobblestone below. One of those rectangles had just been blotted out by the shadow of a man. Without so much as a glance toward the top of the tower, Hulahot spun and dashed toward the Giralda stairs. Chapter 99. Fontaine pounded his fist into his hand. He paced the conference room and stared out at the spinning crypto lights.
"Abort, goddammit, abort!"
Midge appeared in the doorway, waving a fresh readout.
"Director, Strathmore can't abort."
"What?"
Brinkerhoff and Fontaine gasped in unison.
"He tried, sir." Midge held up the report. 4 times already. Translators locked in some sort of endless loop."
Fontaine spun and stared back out the window.
"Jesus Christ."
The conference room phone rang sharply. The director threw up his arms.
"It's got to be Strathmore. About goddamn time."
Brinkerhoff scooped up the phone.
"Director's office."
Fontaine held out his hand for the receiver. Brinkerhoff looked uneasy and turned to Midge.
"It's Jabba. He wants you."
The director swung his gaze over to Midge, who was already crossing the room. She activated the speakerphone.
"Go ahead, Jabba."
Jabba's metallic voice boomed into the room.
"Midge, I'm in the main databank. We're showing some strange stuff down here. I was wondering if..." "Damn it, Jabba!"
Midge came unglued.
"That's what I've been trying to tell you."
"It could be nothing," Jabba hedged, "but..."
"Stop saying that. It's not nothing. Whatever's going on down there, take it seriously. Very seriously. My data isn't fried. Never has been, never will."
She started to hang up, and then added, "Oh, and Jabba? Just so there aren't any surprises, Strathmore bypassed Gauntlet." Chapter 100. Hulahot took the Heralda stairs, three at a time. The only light in the spiral passage was from small, open-air windows every 180 degrees.
"He's trapped. David Becker will die."
Hulahot circled upward, gun drawn. He kept to the outside wall in case Becker decided to attack from above. The iron candle poles on each landing would make good weapons if Becker decided to use one. But by staying wide, Hulahot would be able to spot him in time. Hulahot's gun had a range significantly longer than a 5-foot candle pole. Hulahot moved quickly, but carefully. The stairs were steep. Tourists had died here. This was not America. No safety signs, no handrails, no insurance disclaimers. This was Spain. If you were stupid enough to fall, it was your own damn fault, regardless of who built the stairs. Hulahot paused at one of the shoulder-high openings and glanced out. He was on the north face and, from the look of things, about halfway up. The opening to the viewing platform was visible around the corner. The staircase to the top was empty. David Becker had not challenged him. Hulahot realized maybe Becker had not seen him enter the tower. That meant the element of surprise was on Hulahot's side as well. Not that he'd need it. Hulahot held all the cards. Even the layout of the tower was in his favor. The staircase met the viewing platform in the southwest corner. Hulahot would have a clear line of fire to every point of the cell with no possibility that Becker could get behind him. And to top things off, Hulahot would be moving out of the dark into the light.
"A killing box," he mused.
Hulahot measured the distance to the doorway. 7 steps. He practiced the kill in his mind. If he stayed right as he approached the opening, he would be able to see the leftmost corner of the platform before he reached it. If Becker was there, Hulahot would fire. If not, he would shift inside and enter moving east, facing the right corner, the only place remaining that Becker could be. He smiled. Subject, David Becker. Terminated. The time had come. He checked his weapon. With a violent surge, Hulahot dashed up. The platform swung into view. The left corner was empty. As rehearsed, Hulahot shifted inside and burst through the opening facing right. He fired into the corner. The bullet ricocheted back off the bare wall and barely missed him. Hulahot wheeled wildly and let out a muted scream. There was no one there. David Becker had vanished. 3 flights below, suspended 325 feet over the Jardín de los Naranjos, David Becker hung on the outside of the Heralda like a man doing chin-ups on a window ledge. As Hulahot had been racing up the staircase, Becker had descended 3 flights and lowered himself out one of the openings. He dropped out of sight just in time. The killer had run right by him. He'd been in too much of a hurry to notice the white knuckles grasping the window ledge. Hanging outside the window, Becker thanked God that his daily squash routine involved 20 minutes on the Nautilus machine to develop his biceps for a harder overhead serve. Unfortunately, despite his strong arms, Becker was now having trouble pulling himself back in. His shoulders burned. His side felt as if it were tearing open. The rough-cut stone ledge provided little grip, grating into his fingertips like broken glass. Becker knew it was only a matter of seconds before his assailant would come running down from above. From the higher ground, the killer would undoubtedly see Becker's fingers on the ledge. Becker closed his eyes and pulled. He knew he would need a miracle to escape death. His fingers were losing their leverage. He glanced down past his dangling legs. The drop was the length of a football field to the orange trees below. Unsurvivable. The pain in his side was getting worse. Footsteps now thundered above him, loud, leaping footsteps rushing down the stairs. Becker closed his eyes. It was now or never. He gritted his teeth and pulled. The stone tore against the skin on his wrists as he yanked himself upward. The footsteps were coming fast. Becker grappled at the inside of the opening, trying to secure his hold. He kicked his feet. His body felt like lead, as if someone had a rope tied to his legs and were pulling him down. He fought it. He surged up onto his elbows. He was in plain view now, his head half through the window, like a man in a guillotine. He wriggled his legs, kicking himself into the opening. He was halfway through. His torso now hung into the stairwell. The footsteps were close. Becker grabbed the sides of the opening and in a single motion launched his body through. He hit the staircase hard. Houlihan sensed Becker's body hit the floor just below him. He leapt forward, gun leveled. A window spun into view.
This is it.
Houlihan moved to the outside wall and aimed down the staircase. Becker's legs dashed out of sight just around the curve. Houlihan fired in frustration. The bullet ricocheted down the stairwell. As Houlihan dashed down the stairs after his prey, he kept to the outside wall for the widest angle view. As the staircase revolved into view before him, it seemed Becker was always 180 degrees ahead of him, just out of sight. Becker had taken the inside track, cutting off the angle and leaping four or five stairs at a time. Houlihan stayed with him. It would take only a single shot. Houlihan was gaining. He knew that even if Becker made the bottom, there was nowhere to run. Houlihan could shoot him in the back as he crossed the open patio. The desperate race spiraled downward. Houlihan moved inside to the faster track. He sensed he was gaining. He could see Becker's shadow every time they passed an opening. Down, down, spiraling. It seemed that Becker was always just around the corner. Houlihan kept one eye on his shadow and one eye on the stairs. Suddenly it appeared to Houlihan that Becker's shadow had stumbled. It made an erratic lurch left and then seemed to spin in midair and sail back toward the center of the stairwell. Houlihan leapt forward.
I've got him.
On the stairs in front of Houlihan, there was a flash of steel. It jabbed into the air from around the corner. It thrust forward like a fencer's foil at ankle level. Houlihan tried to shift left, but it was too late. The object was between his ankles. His back foot came forward, caught it hard, and the post slammed across his shin. Houlihan's arms went out for support, but found only empty air. He was abruptly airborne, turning on his side. As Houlihan sailed downward, he passed over David Becker, prone on his stomach, arms outstretched. The candle pole in his hands was now caught up in Houlihan's legs as he spun downward. Houlihan crashed into the outside wall before he hit the staircase. When he finally found the floor, he was tumbling. His gun clattered to the floor. Houlihan's body kept going, head over heels. He spiraled five complete 360-degree rotations before he rolled to a stop. 12 more steps, and he would have tumbled out onto the patio. Chapter 101. David Becker had never held a gun, but he was holding one now. Houlihan's body was twisted and mangled in the darkness of the Giralda staircase. Becker pressed the barrel of the gun against his assailant's temple and carefully knelt down. One twitch, and Becker would fire. But there was no twitch. Houlihan was dead. Becker dropped the gun and collapsed on the stairs. For the first time in ages, he felt tears well up. He fought them. He knew there would be time for emotion later. Now it was time to go home. Becker tried to stand, but he was too tired to move. He sat a long while, exhausted, on the stone staircase. Absently, he studied the twisted body before him. The killer's eyes began to glaze over, gazing out at nothing in particular. Somehow, his glasses were still intact. They were odd glasses, Becker thought, with a wire protruding from behind the earpiece and leading to a pack of some sort on his belt. Becker was too exhausted to be curious. As he sat alone in the staircase and collected his thoughts, Becker shifted his gaze to the ring on his finger. His vision had cleared somewhat, and he could finally read the inscription. As he had suspected, it was not English. He stared at the engraving for a long moment, and then frowned. This is worth killing for? The morning sun was blinding when Becker finally stepped out of the Giralda onto the patio. The pain in his side had subsided, and his vision was returning to normal. He stood a moment, in a daze, enjoying the fragrance of the orange blossoms. Then he began moving slowly across the patio. As Becker strode away from the tower, a van skidded to a stop nearby. Two men jumped out. They were young and dressed in military fatigues. They advanced on Becker with the stiff precision of well-tuned machines. David Becker? one demanded. Becker stopped short, amazed they knew his name.
Who are you?
Come with us, please, right away. There was something unreal about the encounter, something that made Becker's nerve endings start to tingle again. He found himself backing away from them. The shorter man gave Becker an icy stare.
This way, Mr. Becker, right now.
Becker turned to run, but he only took one step. One of the men drew a weapon. There was a shot. A searing lance of pain erupted in Becker's chest. It rocketed to his skull. His fingers went stiff, and Becker fell. An instant later, there was nothing but blackness. Chapter 102. Strathmore reached the translator floor and stepped off the catwalk into an inch of water. The giant computer shuddered beside him. Huge droplets of water fell like rain through the swirling mist. The warning horns sounded like thunder. The commander looked across at the failed main generators. Phil Chartrukian was there. His charred remains splayed across a set of coolant fins. The scene looked like some sort of perverse Halloween display. Although Strathmore regretted the man's death, there was no doubt it had been a warranted casualty. Phil Chartrukian had left Strathmore no choice. When the SysSec came racing up from the depths, screaming about a virus, Strathmore met him on the landing and tried to talk sense to him. But Chartrukian was beyond reason.
We've got a virus. I'm calling Jabba.
When he tried to push past, the commander blocked his way. The landing was narrow. They struggled. The railing was low. It was ironic, Strathmore thought, that Chartrukian had been right about the virus all along. The man's plunge had been chilling. A momentary howl of terror, and then silence. But it was not half as chilling as the next thing Commander Strathmore saw. Greg Hale was staring up at him from the shadows below, a look of utter horror on his face. It was then that Strathmore knew Greg Hale would die. Translator crackled, and Strathmore turned his attention back to the task at hand. Kill power. The circuit breaker was on the other side of the freon pumps to the left of the body. Strathmore could see it clearly. All he had to do was pull a lever, and the remaining power in Krypto would die. Then, after a few seconds, he could restart the main generators. All doorways and functions would come back online. The freon would start flowing again, and Translator would be safe. But as Strathmore slogged toward the breaker, he realized there was one final obstacle. Chartrukian's body was still on the main generator's cooling fins. Killing and then restarting the main generator would only cause another power failure. The body had to be moved. Strathmore eyed the grotesque remains and made his way over. Reaching up, he grabbed a wrist. The flesh was like styrofoam. The tissue had been fried. The whole body was devoid of moisture. The commander closed his eyes, tightened his grip around the wrist, and pulled. The body slid an inch or two. Strathmore pulled harder. The body slid again. The commander braced himself and pulled with all his might. Suddenly, he was tumbling backward. He landed hard on his backside up against a power casement. Struggling to sit up in the rising water, Strathmore stared down in horror at the object in his fist. It was Chartrukian's forearm. It had broken off at the elbow. Upstairs, Susan continued her wait. She sat on the Node 3 couch feeling paralyzed. Hale lay at her feet. She couldn't imagine what was taking the commander so long. Minutes passed. She tried to push David from her thoughts, but it was no use. With every blast of the horns, Hale's words echoed inside her head. I'm truly sorry about David Becker. Susan thought she would lose her mind. She was about to jump up and race onto the crypto floor when finally it happened. Strathmore had thrown the switch and killed all power. The silence that engulfed Krypto was instantaneous. The horns choked off mid-blare, and the Node 3 monitors flickered to black. Greg Hale's corpse disappeared into the darkness, and Susan instinctively yanked her legs up onto the couch. She wrapped Strathmore's suit coat around her. Darkness. Silence. She had never heard such quiet in Krypto. There'd always been the low hum of the generators. But now there was nothing, only the great beast heaving and sighing in relief, crackling, hissing, slowly cooling down. Susan closed her eyes and prayed for David. Her prayer was a simple one, that God protect the man she loved. Not being a religious woman, Susan had never expected to hear a response to her prayer. But when there was a sudden shuddering against her chest, she jolted upright. She clutched her chest. A moment later, she understood. The vibrations she felt were not the hand of God at all. They were coming from the commander's jacket pocket. He had set the vibrating silent ring feature on his sky pager. Someone was sending Commander Strathmore a message. Six stories below, Strathmore stood at the circuit breaker. The sublevels of Crypto were now as dark as the deepest night. He stood a moment, enjoying the blackness. The water poured down from above. It was a midnight storm. Strathmore tilted his head back and let the warm droplets wash away his guilt. I'm a survivor. He knelt and washed the last of Chartreukian's flesh from his hands. His dreams for Digital Fortress had failed. He could accept that. Susan was all that mattered now. For the first time in decades, he truly understood that there was more to life than country and honor. I sacrificed the best years of my life for country and honor. But what about love? He had deprived himself for far too long. And for what? To watch some young professor steal away his dreams? Strathmore had nurtured Susan. He had protected her. He had earned her. And now, at last, he would have her. Susan would seek shelter in his arms when there was nowhere else to turn. She would come to him, helpless, wounded by loss. And in time, he would show her that love heals all. Honor, country, love. David Becker was about to die for all three. Chapter 103. The commander rose through the trapdoor like Lazarus back from the dead. Despite his soggy clothes, his step was light. He strode toward Node 3, toward Susan, toward his future. The crypto floor was again bathed in light. Freon was flowing downward through the smoldering translator like oxygenated blood. Strathmore knew it would take a few minutes for the coolant to reach the bottom of the hull and prevent the lowest processors from igniting, but he was certain he'd acted in time. He exhaled in victory, never suspecting the truth, that it was already too late. I'm a survivor, he thought. Ignoring the gaping hole in the Node 3 wall, he strode to the electronic doors. They hissed open. He stepped inside. Susan was standing before him, damp and tousled in his blazer. She looked like a freshman co-ed who'd been caught in the rain. He felt like the senior who'd lent her his varsity sweater. For the first time in years, he felt young. His dream was coming true. But as Strathmore moved closer, he felt he was staring into the eyes of a woman he did not recognize. Her gaze was like ice. The softness was gone. Susan Fletcher stood rigid like an immovable statue. The only perceptible motion were the tears welling in her eyes. Susan? A single tear rolled down her quivering cheek. What is it? The commander pleaded. The puddle of blood beneath Hale's body had spread across the carpet like an oil spill. Strathmore glanced uneasily at the corpse, then back at Susan. Could she possibly know? There was no way. Strathmore knew he had covered every base. Susan, he said, stepping closer. What is it? Susan did not move. Are you worried about David? There was a slight quiver in her upper lip. Strathmore stepped closer. He was going to reach for her, but he hesitated. The sound of David's name had apparently cracked the dam of grief. Slowly at first, a quiver, a tremble, and then a thundering wave of misery seemed to course through her veins. Barely able to control her shuddering lips, Susan opened her mouth to speak. Nothing came. Without ever breaking the icy gaze she'd locked on Strathmore, she took her hand from the pocket of his blazer. In her hand was an object. She held it out, shaking. Strathmore half expected to look down and see the Beretta leveled at his gut. But the gun was still on the floor, propped safely in Hale's hand. The object Susan was holding was smaller, Strathmore stared down at it, and an instant later, he understood. As Strathmore stared, reality warped, and time slowed to a crawl. He could hear the sound of his own heart. The man who had triumphed over giants for so many years had been outdone in an instant, slain by love, by his own foolishness. In a simple act of chivalry, he had given Susan his jacket, and with it, his sky pager. Now it was Strathmore who went rigid. Susan's hand was shaking. The pager fell at Hale's feet. With a look of astonishment and betrayal that Strathmore would never forget, Susan Fletcher raced past him, out of Node 3. The commander let her go. In slow motion, he bent and retrieved the pager. There were no new messages. Susan had read them all. Strathmore scrolled desperately through the list. Subject, Ensai Tankado, terminated. Subject, Pierre Clouchard, terminated. Subject, Hans Huber, terminated. Subject, Rocio Eva Granada, terminated. The list went on. Strathmore felt a wave of horror.
I can explain. She will understand. Honor. Country.
But there was one message he had not yet seen. One message he could never explain. Trembling, he scrolled to the final transmission. Subject, David Becker. Terminated. Strathmore hung his head. His dream was over. Chapter 104. Susan staggered out of Node 3. Subject, David Becker. Terminated. As if in a dream, she moved toward Crypto's main exit. Greg Hale's voice echoed in her mind.
Susan, Strathmore's going to kill me. Susan, the commander's in love with you.
Susan reached the enormous circular portal and began stabbing desperately at the keypad. The door did not move. She tried again, but the enormous slab refused to rotate. Susan let out a muted scream. Apparently, the power outage had deleted the exit codes. She was still trapped. Without warning, two arms closed around her from behind, grasping her half-numb body. The touch was familiar yet repulsive. It lacked the brute strength of Greg Hale, but there was a desperate roughness to it, an inner determination like steel. Susan turned. The man restraining her was desolate, frightened. It was a face she had never seen.
Susan, Strathmore begged, holding her. I can explain.
She tried to pull away. The commander held fast. Susan tried to scream, but she had no voice. She tried to run, but strong hands restrained her, pulling her backward.
I love you, the voice was whispering. I've loved you forever.
Susan's stomach turned over and over.
Stay with me.
Susan's mind whirled with grisly images. David's bright green eyes, slowly closing for the last time. Greg Hale's corpse seeping blood onto the carpet. Phil Chartrukian burned and broken on the generators.
The pain will pass, the voice said. You'll love again.
Susan heard nothing.
Stay with me, the voice pleaded. I'll heal your wounds.
She struggled. Helpless.
I did it for us. We're made for each other. Susan, I love you.
The words flowed as if he had waited a decade to speak them.
I love you. I love you.
In that instant, 30 yards away, as if rebutting Strathmore's vile confession, Translator let out a savage, pitiless hiss. The sound was an entirely new one, a distant, ominous sizzling that seemed to grow like a serpent in the depths of the silo. The Freon, it appeared, had not reached its mark in time. The commander let go of Susan and turned toward the $2 billion computer. His eyes went wide with dread.
No!
He grabbed his head.
No!
The 6-story rocket began to tremble. Strathmore staggered, a faltering step, toward the thundering hull. Then he fell to his knees, a sinner before an angry god. It was no use. At the base of the silo, Translator's titanium strontium processors had just ignited. Chapter 105. A fireball racing upward through 3 million silicon chips makes a unique sound. The crackling of a forest fire, the howling of a tornado, the steaming gush of a geyser, all trapped within a reverberant hull. It was the devil's breath pouring through a sealed cavern looking for escape. Strathmore knelt transfixed by the horrific noise rising toward them. The world's most expensive computer was about to become an 8-story inferno. In slow motion, Strathmore turned back toward Susan. She stood paralyzed beside the crypto door. Strathmore stared at her tear-streaked face. She seemed to shimmer in the fluorescent light.
She's an angel, he thought.
He searched her eyes for heaven, but all he could see was death. It was the death of trust. Love and honor were gone. The fantasy that had kept him going all these years was dead. He would never have Susan Fletcher. Never. The sudden emptiness that gripped him was overwhelming. Susan gazed vaguely toward Translator. She knew that trapped within the ceramic shell, a fireball was racing toward them. She sensed it rising faster and faster, feeding on the oxygen released by the burning chips. In moments, the cryptodome would be a blazing inferno. Susan's mind told her to run, but David's dead weight pressed down all around her. She thought she heard his voice calling to her, telling her to escape, but there was nowhere to go. Crypto was a sealed tomb. It didn't matter. The thought of death did not frighten her. Death would stop the pain. She would be with David. The crypto floor began to tremble, as if below it an angry sea monster were rising out of the depths. David's voice seemed to be calling, "Run, Susan! Run!" Strathmore was moving toward her now, his face a distant memory. His cool gray eyes were lifeless. The patriot who had lived in her mind a hero had died a murderer. His arms were suddenly around her again, clutching desperately. He kissed her cheeks.
"Forgive me," he begged.
Susan tried to pull away, but Strathmore held on. Translator began vibrating like a missile preparing to launch. The crypto floor began to shake. Strathmore held her tighter.
"Hold me, Susan. I need you."
A violent surge of fury filled Susan's limbs. David's voice called out again.
"I love you. Escape."
In a sudden burst of energy, Susan tore free. The roar from Translator became deafening. The fire was at the silo's peak. Translator groaned, straining at its seams. David's voice seemed to lift Susan, guide her. She dashed across the crypto floor and started up Strathmore's catwalk stairs. Behind her, Translator let out a deafening roar. As the last of the silicon chips disintegrated, a tremendous updraft of heat tore through the upper casing of the silo and sent shards of ceramic 30 feet into the air. Instantly, the oxygen-rich air of crypto rushed in to fill the enormous vacuum. Susan reached the upper landing and grabbed the banister when the tremendous rush of wind ripped at her body. It spun her around in time to see the deputy director of operations far below, staring up at her from beside Translator. There was a storm raging all around him, and yet there was peace in his eyes. His lips parted, and he mouthed his final word.
"Susan."
The air rushing into Translator ignited on contact. In a brilliant flash of light, Commander Trevor Strathmore passed from man to silhouette to legend. When the blast hit Susan, it blew her back 15 feet into Strathmore's office. All she remembered was a searing heat. Chapter 106. In the window of the director's conference room, high above the cryptodome, three faces appeared, breathless. The explosion had shaken the entire NSA complex. Leland Fontaine, Chad Brinkerhoff, and Midge Milken all stared out in silent horror. 70 feet below, the crypto dome was blazing. The polycarbonate roof was still intact, but beneath the transparent shell, a fire raged. Black smoke swirled like fog inside the dome. The three stared down without a word. The spectacle had an eerie grandeur to it. Fontaine stood a long moment. He finally spoke, his voice faint but unwavering.
Midge, get a crew down there. Now.
Across the suite, Fontaine's phone began to ring. It was Jabba. Chapter 107. Susan had no idea how much time had passed. A burning in her throat pulled her to her senses. Disoriented, she studied her surroundings. She was on a carpet behind a desk. The only light in the room was a strange orange flickering. The air smelled of burning plastic. The room she was standing in was not really a room at all. It was a devastated shell. The curtains were on fire, and the plexiglass walls were smoldering. Then she remembered it all.
David!
In a rising panic, she pulled herself to her feet. The air felt caustic in her windpipe. She stumbled to the doorway, looking for a way out. As she crossed the threshold, her leg swung out over an abyss. She grabbed the doorframe just in time. The catwalk had disappeared. 50 feet below was a twisted collapse of steaming metal. Susan scanned the crypto floor in horror. It was a sea of fire. The melted remains of 3 million silicon chips had erupted from translator like lava. Thick, acrid smoke billowed upward. Susan knew the smell. Silicon smoke. Deadly poison. Retreating into the remains of Strathmore's office, she began to feel faint. Her throat burned. The entire place was filled with a fiery light. Crypto was dying.
So will I, she thought.
For a moment, she considered the only possible exit, Strathmore's elevator. But she knew it was useless. The electronics never would have survived the blast. But as Susan made her way through the thickening smoke, she recalled Hale's words.
The elevator runs on power from the main building. I've seen the schematics.
Susan knew that was true. She also knew the entire shaft was encased in reinforced concrete. The fumes swirled all around her. She stumbled through the smoke toward the elevator door. But when she got there, she saw that the elevator's call button was dark. Susan jabbed fruitlessly at the darkened panel. Then she fell to her knees and pounded on the door. She stopped almost instantly. Something was whirring behind the doors. Startled, she looked up. It sounded like the carriage was right there. She stabbed at the button again. Again, a whirring behind the doors. Suddenly, she saw it. The call button was not dead. It had just been covered with black soot. It now glowed faintly beneath her smudged fingerprints.
There's power.
With a surge of hope, she punched at the button. Over and over, something behind the doors engaged. She could hear the ventilation fan in the elevator car.
The carriage is here. Why won't the damn doors open?
Through the smoke, she spied the tiny secondary keypad. Lettered buttons, A through Z. In a wave of despair, Susan remembered. The password. The smoke was starting to curl in through the melted window frames. Again, she banged on the elevator doors. They refused to open.
The password, she thought. Strathmore never told me the password.
Silicon smoke was now filling the office. Choking, Susan fell against the elevator in defeat. The ventilation fan was running just a few feet away. She lay there, dazed, gulping for air. She closed her eyes, but again David's voice woke her.
Escape, Susan. Open the door. Escape.
She opened her eyes, expecting to see his face, those wild green eyes, that playful smile. But the letters A to Z came into focus. The password. Susan stared at the letters on the keypad. She could barely keep them in focus. On the LED below the keypad, 5 empty spots awaited entry.
A 5-character password, she thought.
She instantly knew the odds. 26 to the 5th power. 11,881,376 possible choices. At one guess every second, it would take 19 weeks. As Susan Fletcher lay choking on the floor beneath the keypad, the commander's pathetic voice came to her. He was calling to her again.
I love you, Susan. I've always loved you. Susan. Susan. Susan.
She knew he was dead, and yet his voice was relentless. She heard her name over and over.
Susan. Susan.
Then, in a moment of chilling clarity, she knew. Trembling weakly, she reached up to the keypad and typed the password. S-U-S-A-N. An instant later, the doors slid open. Chapter 108. Strathmore's elevator dropped fast. Inside the carriage, Susan sucked deep breaths of fresh air into her lungs. Dazed, she steadied herself against the wall as the car slowed to a stop. A moment later, some gears clicked, and the conveyor began moving again, this time horizontally. Susan felt the carriage accelerate as it began rumbling toward the main NSA complex. Finally, it whirred to a stop, and the doors opened. Coughing, Susan Fletcher stumbled into a darkened cement corridor. She found herself in a tunnel, low-ceilinged and narrow. A double yellow line stretched out before her. The line disappeared into an empty, dark hollow. The underground highway. She staggered toward the tunnel, holding the wall for guidance. Behind her, the elevator door slid shut. Once again, Susan Fletcher was plunged into darkness. Silence. Nothing except a faint humming in the walls. A humming that grew louder. Suddenly, it was as if dawn were breaking. The blackness thinned to a hazy gray. The walls of the tunnel began to take shape. All at once, a small vehicle whipped around the corner, its headlight blinding her. Susan stumbled back against the wall and shielded her eyes. There was a gust of air, and the transport whipped past. An instant later, there was a deafening squeal of rubber on cement. The hum approached once again, this time in reverse. Seconds later, the vehicle came to a stop beside her.
"Miss Fletcher!"
an astonished voice exclaimed. Susan gazed at a vaguely familiar shape in the driver's seat of an electric golf cart.
"Jesus!"
the man gasped.
"Are you okay? We thought you were dead."
Susan stared blankly.
"Chad Brinkerhoff,"
he sputtered, studying the shell-shocked cryptographer.
"Directorial PA."
Susan could only manage a dazed whimper.
"Translator,"
Brinkerhoff nodded.
"Forget it. Get on."
The beam of the golf cart's headlights whipped across the cement walls.
"There's a virus in the main databank," Brinkerhoff blurted. "I know,"
Susan heard herself whisper.
"We need you to help us."
Susan was fighting back the tears.
"Strathmore, he..."
"We know," Brinkerhoff said.
"He bypassed Gauntlet."
"Yes, and..."
The words got stuck in her throat.
"He killed David."
Brinkerhoff put a hand on her shoulder.
"Almost there, Miss Fletcher. Just hold on."
The high-speed Kensington golf cart rounded a corner and skidded to a stop. Beside them, branching off perpendicular to the tunnel, was a hallway, dimly lit by red floor lighting.
"Come on,"
Brinkerhoff said, helping her out. He guided her into the corridor. Susan drifted behind him in a fog. The tiled passageway sloped downward at a steep incline. Susan grabbed the handrail and followed Brinkerhoff down. The air began to grow cooler. They continued their descent. As they dropped deeper into the earth, the tunnel narrowed. From somewhere behind them came the echo of footsteps. A strong, purposeful gait. The footsteps grew louder. Both Brinkerhoff and Susan stopped and turned. Striding toward them was an enormous black man. Susan had never seen him before. As he approached, he fixed her with a penetrating stare.
"Who's this?" he demanded.
"Susan Fletcher,"
Brinkerhoff replied. The enormous man arched his eyebrows. Even sooty and soaked, Susan Fletcher was more striking than he had imagined.
"And the commander?"
he demanded. Brinkerhoff shook his head. The man said nothing. He stared off a moment. Then he turned back to Susan.
"Leland Fontaine," he said, offering her his hand. "Glad you're okay."
Susan stared. She'd always known she'd meet the director someday, but this was not the introduction she'd envisioned.
"Come along, Miss Fletcher," Fontaine said, leading the way. "We'll need all the help we can get."
Looming in the reddish haze at the bottom of the tunnel, a steel wall blocked their way. Fontaine approached and typed an entry code into a recessed cipher box. He then placed his right hand against a small glass panel. A strobe flashed. A moment later, the massive wall thundered left. There was only one NSA chamber more sacred than Crypto, and Susan Fletcher sensed she was about to enter it. Chapter 109. The command center for the NSA's main databank looked like a scaled-down NASA mission control. A dozen computer workstations faced the 30-foot by 40-foot video wall at the far end of the room. On the screen, numbers and diagrams flashed in rapid succession, appearing and disappearing as if someone were channel surfing. A handful of technicians raced wildly from station to station, trailing long sheets of printout paper and yelling commands. It was chaos. Susan stared at the dazzling facility. She vaguely remembered that 250 metric tons of earth had been excavated to create it. The chamber was located 214 feet below ground, where it would be totally impervious to flux bombs and nuclear blasts. On a raised workstation in the center of the room stood Jabba. He bellowed orders from his platform like a king to his subjects. Illuminated on the screen directly behind him was a message. The message was all too familiar to Susan. The billboard-sized text hung ominously over Jabba's head. Only the truth will save you now. Enter passkey. As if trapped in some surreal nightmare, Susan followed Fontaine toward the podium. Her world was a slow-motion blur. Jabba saw them coming and wheeled like an enraged bull.
I built Gauntlet for a reason.
Gauntlet's gone, Fontaine replied evenly.
Old news, Director, Jabba spat. The shockwave knocked me on my ass. Where's Strathmore?
Commander Strathmore is dead.
Poetic fucking justice.
Cool it, Jabba, the director ordered. Bring us up to speed. How bad is this virus?
Jabba stared at the director a long moment, and then without warning, he burst out laughing.
A virus?
His harsh guffaw resonated through the underground chamber.
Is that what you think this is?
Fontaine kept his cool. Jabba's insolence was way out of line, but Fontaine knew this was not the time or place to handle it. Down here, Jabba outranked God himself. Computer problems had a way of ignoring the normal chain of command.
It's not a virus?
Brinkerhoff exclaimed hopefully. Jabba snorted in disgust.
Viruses have replication strings, pretty boy. This doesn't.
Susan hovered nearby, unable to focus.
Then what's going on? Fontaine demanded. I thought we had a virus.
Jabba sucked in a long breath and lowered his voice.
Viruses, he said, wiping sweat from his face. Viruses reproduce. They create clones. They're vain and stupid, binary egomaniacs. They pump out babies faster than rabbits. That's their weakness. You can crossbreed them into oblivion if you know what you're doing. Unfortunately, this program has no ego, no need to reproduce. It's clear-headed and focused. In fact, when it's accomplished its objective here, it will probably commit digital suicide.
Jabba held out his arms reverently to the projected havoc on the enormous screen.
Ladies and gentlemen, he sighed, meet the kamikaze of computer invaders. The worm. Worm?
Brinkerhoff groaned. It seemed like a mundane term to describe the insidious intruder.
Worm, Jabba smoldered. No complex structures, just instinct. Eat, shit, crawl. That's it. Simplicity. Deadly simplicity. It does what it's programmed to do and then checks out.
Fontaine eyed Jabba sternly.
And what is this worm programmed to do?
No clue, Jabba replied. Right now it's spreading out and attaching itself to all our classified data. After that it could do anything. It might decide to delete all the files, or it might just decide to print smiley faces on certain White House transcripts.
Fontaine's voice remained cool and collected.
Can you stop it?
Jabba let out a long sigh and faced the screen.
I have no idea. It all depends on how pissed off the author is.
He pointed to the message on the wall.
Anybody want to tell me what the hell that means?
Only the truth will save you now. Enter passkey. Jabba waited for a response and got none.
Looks like someone's messing with us, Director. Blackmail. This is a ransom note if I ever saw one.
Susan's voice was a whisper, empty and hollow.
It's Ensai Tankato.
Jabba turned to her. He stared a moment, wide-eyed.
Tankato?
Susan nodded weakly.
He wanted our confession, about Translator. But it cost him his...
Confession? Brinkerhoff interrupted, looking stunned.
Tankato wants us to confess we have Translator. I'd say it's a bit late for that.
Susan opened her mouth to speak, but Jabba took over.
Looks like Tankato's got a kill code,
he said, gazing up at the message on the screen. Everyone turned.
Kill code? Brinkerhoff demanded.
Jabba nodded.
Yeah, a passkey that stops the worm. Simply put, if we admit we have Translator, Tankato gives us a kill code. We type it in and save the databank. Welcome to digital extortion.
Fontaine stood like rock, unwavering.
How long have we got?
About an hour, Jabba said. Just time enough to call a press conference and spill our guts.
Recommendation, Fontaine demanded. What do you propose we do?
A recommendation? Jabba blurted in disbelief. You want a recommendation? I'll give you a recommendation. You quit fucking around, that's what you do.
Easy, the director warned.
Director, Jabba sputtered, right now Ensai Tankato owns this databank. Give him whatever he wants. If he wants the world to know about Translator, call CNN and drop your shorts. Translator's a hole in the ground now anyway. What the hell do you care?
There was a silence. Fontaine seemed to be considering his options. Susan began to speak, but Jabba beat her to it.
What are you waiting for, Director? Get Tankato on the phone. Tell him you'll play ball. We need that kill code or this whole place is going down.
Nobody moved.
Are you all insane? Jabba screamed. Call Tankato. Tell him we fold. Get me that kill code now.
Jabba whipped out his cellular phone and switched it on.
Never mind. Get me his number. I'll call the little prick myself.
Don't bother, Susan said in a whisper. Tankato's dead.
After a moment of confused astonishment, the implications hit Jabba like a bullet to the gut. The huge sysac looked like he was about to crumble.
Dead? But then, that means we can't...
That means we'll need a new plan, Fontaine said matter-of-factly. Jabba's eyes were still glazed with shock when someone in the back of the room began shouting wildly.
Jabba! Jabba!
It was Soshi Kuta, his head techie. She came running toward the podium, trailing a long printout. She looked terrified.
Jabba, she gasped. The worm. I just found out what it's programmed to do.
Soshi thrust the paper into Jabba's hands.
I pulled this from the system activity probe. We isolated the worm's execute commands. Have a look at the programming. Look what it's planning to do.
Dazed, the chief syssec read the printout. Then he grabbed the handrail for support.
Oh, Jesus,
Jabba gasped.
Tankato, you bastard.
Chapter 110. Jabba stared blankly at the printout Soshi had just handed him. Pale, he wiped his forehead on his sleeve.
Director, we have no choice. We've got to kill power to the databank.
Unacceptable. Fontaine replied. The results would be devastating.
Jabba knew the director was right. There were over 3,000 ISDN connections tying into the NSA databank from all over the world. Every day, military commanders accessed up-to-the-instant satellite photos of enemy movement. Lockheed engineers downloaded compartmentalized blueprints of new weaponry. Field operatives accessed mission updates. The NSA databank was the backbone of thousands of U.S. government operations. Shutting it down without warning would cause life and death intelligence blackouts all over the globe.
I'm aware of the implications, sir, Jabba said. But we have no choice.
Explain yourself, Fontaine ordered.
He shot a quick glance at Susan, standing beside him on the podium. She seemed miles away. Jabba took a deep breath and wiped his brow again. From the look on his face, it was clear to the group on the podium that they were not going to like what he had to say.
"This worm," Jabba began, "this worm is not an ordinary degenerative cycle. It's a selective cycle. In other words, it's a worm with taste."
Brinkerhoff opened his mouth to speak, but Fontaine waved him off.
"Most destructive applications wipe a databank clean," Jabba continued. "But this one is more complex. It deletes only those files that fall within certain parameters."
"You mean it won't attack the whole databank?" Brinkerhoff asked hopefully. "That's good, right?"
"No!" Jabba exploded. "It's bad! It's very fucking bad!"
"Cool it," Fontaine ordered. "What parameters is this worm looking for? Military? Covert ops?" Jabba shook his head. He eyed Susan, who was still distant, and then Jabba's eyes rose to meet the director's.
"Sir, as you know, anyone who wants to tie into this databank from the outside has to pass a series of security gates before they're admitted."
Fontaine nodded. The databank's access hierarchies were brilliantly conceived. Authorized personnel could dial in via the internet and World Wide Web. Depending on their authorization sequence, they were permitted access to their own compartmentalized zones.
"Because we're tied to the global internet," Jabba explained, "hackers, foreign governments, and EFF sharks circle this databank 24 hours a day and try to break in."
"Yes," Fontaine said, "and 24 hours a day our security filters keep them out.
What's your point?"
Jabba gazed down at the printout.
"My point is this. Tankato's worm is not targeting our data."
He cleared his throat.
"It's targeting our security filters."
Fontaine blanched. Apparently, he understood the implications. This worm was targeting the filters that kept the NSA databank confidential. Without filters, all of the information in the databank would become accessible to everyone on the outside.
"We need to shut down," Jabba repeated. "In about an hour, every third grader with a modem is going to have top U.S. security clearance."
Fontaine stood a long moment without saying a word. Jabba waited impatiently and finally turned to Soshi.
"Soshi, VR, now!"
Soshi dashed off. Jabba relied on VR often. In most computer circles, VR meant virtual reality. But at the NSA, it meant VisRep, visual representation. In a world full of technicians and politicians all having different levels of technical understanding, a graphic representation was often the only way to make a point. A single plummeting graph usually aroused 10 times the reaction inspired by volumes of spreadsheets. Jabba knew a VR of the current crisis would make its point instantly.
"VR!"
Soshi yelled from a terminal at the back of the room. A computer-generated diagram flashed to life on the wall before them. Susan gazed up absently, detached from the madness around her. Everyone in the room followed Jabba's gaze to the screen. The diagram before them resembled a bullseye. In the center was a red circle marked data. Around the center were 5 concentric circles of differing thickness and color. The outermost circle was faded, almost transparent.
"We've got a 5-tier level of defense," Jabba explained. "A primary bastion host, 2 sets of packet filters for FTP and X11, a tunnel block, and finally a PEM-based authorization window right off the Truffle project. The outside shield that's disappearing represents the exposed host. It's practically gone. Within the hour, all 5 shields will follow. After that, the world pours in. Every byte of NSA data becomes public domain."
Fontaine studied the VR, his eyes smoldering. Brinkerhoff let out a weak whimper.
"This worm can open our databank to the world?"
"Child's play for Tankato," Jabba snapped. "Gauntlet was our failsafe. Strathmore blew it."
"It's an act of war," Fontaine whispered, an edge in his voice.
Jabba shook his head. "I really doubt Tankato ever meant for it to go this far. I suspect he intended to be around to stop it."
Fontaine gazed up at the screen and watched the first of the 5 walls disappear entirely.
Bastion host is toast, a technician yelled from the back of the room. Second shield's exposed.
We've got to start shutting down, Jabba urged. From the looks of the VR, we've got about 45 minutes. Shutdown is a complex process.
It was true. The NSA databank had been constructed in such a way as to ensure it would never lose power, accidentally or if attacked. Multiple fail-safes for phone and power were buried in reinforced steel canisters deep underground, and in addition to the feeds from within the NSA complex, there were multiple backups off main public grids. Shutting down involved a complex series of confirmations and protocols, significantly more complicated than the average nuclear submarine missile launch.
We have time, Jabba said, if we hurry. Manual shutdown should take about 30 minutes.
Fontaine continued staring up at the VR, apparently pondering his options.
Director, Jabba exploded. When these firewalls fall, every user on the planet will be issued top security clearance, and I'm talking upper level. Records of covert ops, overseas agents, names and locations of everyone in the Federal Witness Protection Program, launch code confirmations. We must shut down now.
The director seemed unmoved.
There must be some other way.
Yes, Jabba spat. There is. The kill code. But the only guy who knows it happens to be dead.
How about brute force? Brinkerhoff blurted. Can we guess the kill code? Jabba threw up his arms.
For Christ's sake! Kill codes are like encryption keys. Random. Impossible to guess. If you think you can type 600 trillion entries in the next 45 minutes, be my guest.
The kill code's in Spain, Susan offered weakly. Everyone on the podium turned. It was the first thing she had said in a long time. Susan looked up, bleary-eyed.
Tancado gave it away when he died.
Everyone looked lost.
The passkey, Susan shivered as she spoke. Commander Strathmore sent someone to find it.
And, Jabba demanded, did Strathmore's man find it? Susan tried to fight it, but the tears began to flow.
Yes, she choked. I think so.
Chapter 111. An ear-splitting yell cut through the control room.
Sharks!
It was Soshi. Jabba spun toward the VR. Two thin lines had appeared outside the concentric circles. They looked like sperm trying to breach a reluctant egg.
Blood's in the water, folks!
Jabba turned back to the director.
I need a decision. Either we start shutting down, or we'll never make it. As soon as these two intruders see the Bastion host is down, they'll send up a war cry.
Fontaine did not respond. He was deep in thought. Susan Fletcher's news of the passkey in Spain seemed promising to him. He shot a glance toward Susan in the back of the room. She appeared to be in her own world, collapsed in a chair, her head buried in her hands. Fontaine was unsure exactly what had triggered the reaction. But whatever it was, he had no time for it now.
I need a decision, Jabba demanded. Now!
Fontaine looked up. He spoke calmly.
Okay, you've got one.
We are not shutting down. We're going to wait. Jabba's jaw dropped.
What? But that's...
A gamble, Fontaine interrupted. A gamble we just might win.
He took Jabba's cellular and punched a few keys.
Midge, he said. It's Leland Fontaine. Listen carefully.
This book is continued on Disc 10.